With this lecture, we would like to introduce to you Mr. David Ord, an Englishman by birth. He was formerly an editor of the Plain Truth magazine in England and assistant to Mr. Hunting, who was in charge of all English affairs in the Worldwide Church of God. The lecture he is now giving is in progress.
Not because I didn't want to come over, but I've never spoken to a group of Americans before, and especially ones who probably know more about what I'm going to talk about than I do. It's a rather unique situation, but I'm very glad to have the chance anyway. I thought I'd just take a little time this morning and tell you how my thinking led me to the situation I find myself in. I think I am going to be having one more article in The Plain Truth. They're stuck with that one over in England. Now, if you've been seeing that magazine at all lately, you probably haven't seen too many articles from me. That's because I've been writing for the English edition. But they do have one more of mine, which I suppose they'd like to get rid of by now, but it's in there for January. Now, if I mention a group this morning, I'll try not to mention names at all, you know, but if I do, please pardon me, because some of these things become a matter of a force of habit. This whole thing began for me round about 14 months ago. After the decision on divorce and remarriage was made, I had some serious questions about it, because I had always tried to establish my theology on this book, the Bible. And when the decision was made that it was now fine for people who had been divorced to remarry, I didn't understand it. I read the papers that were put out for the ministry of this particular group, and they didn't seem to make sense. It was sort of like you're married, but you're not married. And some are married by God and some aren't. Well, you know, it was confusing. Now, I don't want to misrepresent in any way what was said, but as one concerned with teaching it and writing it to other people, and especially assisting Mr. Hunting, I wanted to understand. So I went to him with my questions. And finally, we came on over to Pasadena here, and we had a chance just 14 months ago to ask those questions in the doctrinal committee. And we took an entire day, in which I guess we got about 5 or 6 hours, I got to speak primarily, to explain where I felt the change was wrong. Now, the upshot of the whole thing is I came for the first time to understand the concept of law. And I don't think many people, even in that doctrinal committee, really understood it, because they would have been able to explain it clearly if they did. But for the first time, I began to understand something about law that I had never seen before. I'd always assumed that God's law is eternal and therefore given to all peoples at all times. And now I began to understand for the very first time that God had given different laws for different people at different times. Now, this was very revelationary to me. In fact, it was shocking. And it prepared my mind for some things that would have come later. Now, long earlier last year, I guess it is now, in 75. Is that right? 75. Yes, we just ended 76. You lose track when you come over here, you know. It upsets your thinking. But along earlier last year, the AICF was born. Now, I knew that some of the concepts of the AICF and the way it was being approached were not necessarily what I would have wanted to have done. But it did do one thing for me. It began to make me think of Christianity in a different way to what I had done before. Now, I think basically I've always been willing to be honest with the book. That's why I pulled out of the religion I was involved in before, when there were some things that were simply not biblical. Well, with the AICF, I started to go around the churches in Britain, and I began to preach about Christianity as a way of life and of a changed mind, as opposed to merely what you might call a religious uniform. And I found that I personally had been hiding behind a uniform of do's and don'ts and a uniform of doctrine. That Christianity had, in a sense, been put under a bushel because of this uniform. Now, what had happened is scriptures like Philippians 2:15 and 16, which I began to preach about, and Matthew 5:14 through 16, began to take on new light. I began to see these as some of the essentials of a Christian way of life. And, you know, I had been locked into a concept of religion of being one of keep a certain day, pay so much money, or whatever, you know. Now, all of that can make you feel righteous. And the change of heart and of mind that needs to come wasn't really there in the way it should have been. I don't mean that I didn't understand some things about basic Christianity, but I think you all know what I mean. That a certain format of religion that makes you feel good can cause you to hide from the real square truths of what a Christian is. So I began preaching this right there in a certain church. In fact, I went to 15 with this particular sermon. And I explained that we had been locked into a system of legalism. Now, at this stage, I had no idea in my mind of the Sabbath being not valid. None at all. Which was interesting. Now, along about that time, I was preaching from Romans 14, verses 15 through 19, which if you're very familiar with this, I'm sure you are, you'll know that that was pretty powerful. I was preaching about this format of religion as opposed to true worship, which is a changed mind. Now, along about this time, I went to Africa. I went with Mr. Harold Jackson. I think many of you would know him. And it was a very interesting experience. It was the Feast of Tabernacles, the last one I'm going to keep. And when I got to Africa, here were people who sincerely wanted to know God's way, whose minds were open. And I began to preach some of the things down there that I'd been preaching in Britain. And they were very excited by it. In fact, Mr. Jackson was very excited. He was very pleased to have me along. And here were people who desperately wanted to have someone to teach them the right way. But they couldn't. They got to come to one or two meetings in a whole year. That's all they could afford. There's no minister. There's no one down there to teach them in any way. And even at this Festival of Tabernacles in Nigeria, I went to Ghana first, and then the same was true in Nigeria, we had about 150 in Nigeria. There were another 150 who would like to have come, but they're from the east, about 1,000 miles away. And they didn't have the money to get over there. And I noticed what the people were eating and the clothes they wore. And I began to realize a discrepancy. Scriptures like James 2 began to bother me. I began to realize that the Feast of Tabernacles in the United States, to a lesser extent in Australia and Britain, can be a very fine time when you can load up on more steaks, more wine, than you do through the rest of the year. But somehow this didn't quite fit with what I was reading in James 2, where here were people who couldn't even get to a service to hear a little bit from the Bible, let alone have fine steaks. And I began to question the validity of a Festival of Tabernacles in a modern-day world. That's the first time I'd ever questioned it. Now, I wasn't questioning whether someone should keep the feast at that stage, but simply the means of keeping it. Well, then, another experience took place. I think you can see how these began to prepare my mind for something. I was beginning to evaluate questions instead of to stomp on them all over when someone brought them up. Now that's quite a change, you know. When someone first questioned the Passover and the date of the Passover, I let them have it. I'd had enough with this change of Pentecost. So when someone asked about the Passover, I really came down like a ton of bricks on them. Now, this was back along about Passover time, just before the Passover. Now, a certain sermon was played on tape all around the world in this particular church. And 2 weeks after I came down like a ton of bricks on someone, I sat and I heard this sermon preparatory to Passover being delivered in the Bricketwood Gymnasium. And I looked, and it was Exodus 12. It was so obvious from Exodus 12 that you could prove that the Passover was on the 14th, not the 15th. And I looked, as this person was explaining how obvious it was, and for the first time, I began to say, wait a minute, look what that says. It was a shock. I wrote a paper. Mr. Hunting sent it back in here. Then I found out that other individuals in this particular organization have the same questions on that. Now, for the first time, my mind in these questions as they came up was not giving stock answers. It was facing the question squarely, because I had learned a bitter lesson from DNR. I had learned I could be dead wrong when I thought I was dead right. And I was wrong. I find I was wrong on Passover. Along about the same time, three of us, Richard Plachet, one other who shall remain nameless, and myself, sat in an office, and some questions on healing began to come up. Now, after the new healing decision was taken, we faced the same trauma as we did with DNR. People were told, well, do anything you want, basically, you know, make your own decision. But people want to know, what does the book say? They don't want to know, well, what can I do and defile my conscience? And here we were facing a decision which we had to give to a group of people, but not able to biblically substantiate it. So we began to talk one afternoon about the question of healing, and is it possible, just remotely, that we might be wrong? Now, we looked at 1 Peter and about Christ's stripes, and 1 Corinthians, where it talks about some are weak and sickly among you. And we thought, no, those scriptures seem to knock in the head all of the other ones which might indicate that it would be all right to help yourself a little bit if you're sick. We dismissed the questions for the moment. They were to come up again a couple of months later. And Richard Plachet began a study of healing. And then the answers to questions began to come. Now, I think you can see how a number of different areas, questions were coming up that were going to lead to something. The catalyst came when Brian... No. Things just come out. You didn't hear what I said. Anyway, someone came over to Britain. That was perfectly accidental. That was not intentional at all. Wipe it off the record. Someone came across to Britain, and I went all round Yorkshire and Scotland with him. And he gained my respect a great deal. I found he was a good Christian in many ways. He asked me a couple of questions over dinner one evening, up in the Lake District, I think it was. He said, Dave, can we really show that our explanation of Colossians 2:16 and Galatians 4:10 is correct? He said, how can we know that as a New Testament church we should keep the Sabbath? And I said, well, it's pretty obvious to me. It's plain as the nose on your face. And he said, well, even some of our own scholars have got questions about the way we're explaining those scriptures. I said, well, I don't know. I don't see any problem with them. But I now had a questioning mind. No more was said. I went back to Brickett Wood. I opened my Bible, and I read the book of Galatians from beginning to end. I read it without any preconceived ideas. I just looked at it and read it. Now, I knew all of the traditional explanations. I'd used them many times, beaten people over the head with them at campaigns we were holding in Britain when they would disagree. Because they didn't know the explanations either. They couldn't refute what I was saying. I read Galatians, and I got the shock of my life. I started to read in Galatians, for example, in chapter 1. I want to show you just briefly, in the time I've got, some of the questions that began to come to mind. Because you might see how an Englishman's mind works, at least one of them anyway, when it comes to understanding this book. Verse 6 of chapter 1, I marvel that you are so soon removed from him that called you into the grace of Christ unto another gospel. Now, I had read that hundreds of times. And this time, because a question had been implanted, and because I'd seen we were wrong on many other things, I looked at this and I thought, that says that the way they were being removed was from grace. Now, I thought that people were turning grace into license, that they were misusing grace. I thought that's what the problem was in Galatia. But no, here were people who were leaving grace for something else. Now, then I read about this other gospel in verse 7, which is not really another one, but a perversion of the gospel of Christ. Now, I had always thought that that was a Samaritan problem. But I looked over in chapter 2. And I think it's about verse 7. And it says, contrariwise, when they saw that the gospel of the uncircumcision was committed to me, as the gospel of the circumcision was to Peter, I began to realize there are two gospels, essentially the same one, which is not another, and yet there are differences. And I began to realize that the problem in Galatia was a discrepancy between a gospel as it was preached to Gentiles and as it was going to Jews. Now, I started to read through the first chapter. And here Paul was making a big point of the fact that the gospel he preached, he did not get from Jews. Now, that was interesting. That struck me. Why is he making this point if the problem is a Samaritan one? Chapter 2. I went up by revelation, verse 2, communicated to them that gospel which I preach among the Gentiles, with difference in some ways to the gospel among the Jews. And Titus, who was with me, being a Greek, was compelled to be circumcised, and that because of false brethren unawares brought in, who came in privately to spy out our liberty, which we have in Christ Jesus, that they might bring us into bondage. Now this began to puzzle me. He's talking here about a Jewish problem. People wanting to bring people back into bondage to Judaism. I read on further down. The problem with Peter, where Paul had to withstand him, Barnabas, to the face, because they were beginning to tell Gentiles that they ought to live as do the Jews. And this was very striking to me. In verse 16, knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ. Now, I'd always thought works of the law were sacrifices. But this was puzzling. Because here I found that works of the law had to do with something in the way people lived, and not sacrificial practices. You're telling them to live as do the Jews, not just to take up with rituals. And then I look further down in the same chapter, and it says in verse 19, I through the law am dead to the law. And then in verse 21, if righteousness come by the law, then Christ is dead in vain. Now here the words works of the law and the law are being used basically synonymously, interchangeably, through this passage. And I started to ask myself, well, now, if works of the law is the same as law, does it mean simply performing the law? What does this mean? I looked in chapter 3 and verse 10 through verse 12, and I found that what is being discussed here is not merely sacrifices and rituals, and of course it didn't take long to hit me that you could hardly sacrifice down in Galatia, but only in Jerusalem. I began to realize the law that's being talked about here is a system of things you can do, a way of living. The just shall live by faith, but here, by contrast, the man that does them shall live in them. It's talking about a mode of life. All of this led me into chapter 3 and verse 17. This I say, that the covenant that was confirmed before of God in Christ, the law. Here's the same word, works of the law, law, it's all talking of the same thing. That became very plain to me. The law, which was 430 years after, and I thought, now, that's interesting. It doesn't say 430 years and 9 months. Cannot disannul that it should make the promise of none effect. Now here I began to realize that the law had been added to the promise. And that what is talked about is the whole package of the law. Not sacrifices as opposed to some other part, but the entirety of the law, which one can perform and live in, and constituted righteousness for the Israelites. And that this had been added to the promise given to Abraham. Verse 19. Now this one puzzled me for a while. I went down and got out, I think it was the International Critical Commentary. In verse 19, wherefore then serves the law, it was added because of transgressions. Now that puzzled me. I thought that must be the sacrificial one. But the context doesn't fit a sacrificial law. It's talking about a law which regulates a way of life and composes righteousness. The commentary showed me that the word because of could have the meaning of for the sake or for the cause of. And I looked at this and I began to tie this in with Romans, where Paul said the law came so that there could be transgressions which he would be conscious of. And I began to realize this passage is saying the law was added in order that there might be transgressions. Now I thought of an illustration which helped explain this to my own mind. It says that before the law there was no sin which could be imputed. I thought of a man driving down a country lane at 100 miles an hour and people scattering in all directions. Now he's transgressing a law of love. And yet if there's no speed limit, the man cannot have sin imputed to him. And I began to understand that God brought in a package of do's and don'ts so that he could impute sin and it would be very clear where people were transgressing. I went on further down this particular one to verse 24, where the law is talked about as a schoolmaster, that we might be justified by faith when we're brought to Christ. I thought, well, this isn't sacrifices, because we're talking about this law you could live by. I went into the next chapter and saw it's talking of the same thing. The context continues right on. The heir, as long as he is a child, differs nothing from a servant, though he be lord of all, but is under tutors and governors until the time appointed of the father. Even so we, now this is we Jews, and that had never struck me before. We Jews were under bondage to the elements of the world. I always thought they were pagan. And here I found Jews, in the context of being under the law, are called under elements of the world. And that was a shock, because that opened up to my mind to understand, and at this point I'd read none of Dr. Martin's literature on the subject, but it opened my mind to understand verses 9 and 10. I began to see the problem with the Galatians is that they were going back under law, and in so doing, they were going back under elements of the world. And for the first time, I began to realize that the whole Jewish system that God gave to Israel is called elements of the world, and that it means simply elementary teachings, basic rudimentary principles for children. And the whole context was one of children growing up to become sons. And I started to realize a child, when he's a little toddler, you tell him you go to bed at 7 o'clock and he goes every night. But when a person becomes an adult, he might go to bed at 2, 3 o'clock sometimes. He doesn't go at the same time every night. He has freedom. And I saw the analogy Paul was bringing out. And when it said that you were going back under days, months, times, and years, it said in context they were going back under the law. Because I noticed verse 21. Tell me, you that desire to be under the law. The whole context from beginning to end that struck me in Galatians is people going back under the law. Now you can imagine what began to happen in my mind at this stage. A lot of questions came up. The first thing I did, I went to Mr. Hunting. And I said to him, look, this is going to sound crazy. I thought I'd probably be fired on the spot, even though we had a very close relationship. I said, there are questions about the Sabbath and holy days. I said, I don't know what to do about them, but I've seen some things in Galatians that I can't answer. Now, I could wriggle around them, but I had enough conscience to not do that, but to face them squarely. I find a lot of people don't have that. They will stubbornly continue to believe something. I found that this past couple of weeks, when you present them with very clear evidence. Well, I didn't do that. I faced this squarely and I took it to Mr. Hunting. And we began to do some studying. Now, he'd already been doing some studying in 1 John. Now, the natural questions that come up out of this, well, what about the Sabbath? Now, I saw in Acts 15, I might go over to that one briefly. In Acts 15, verse 1, brethren were saying, except you be circumcised after the manner of Moses, you cannot be saved. But then when I looked in verse 5, I saw that certain of the sect of the Pharisees, which believed, which I thought was interesting, here are Christian Jews, were saying that it was needful to circumcise them, but then I saw it was not just circumcision that was the issue, but to keep the law of Moses. Now, I read in Galatians chapter 5, isn't it about verse 3, somewhere in there, that if you be circumcised, you're a debtor to do the whole law. And I saw that circumcision was the linchpin of the entirety of the law of Moses. So the question that came up is, if Gentiles don't need to keep the law of Moses, does that include the Sabbath? Is that one of the days, months, times, and years? Is that included in there? Or did the Sabbath come before? Now, this was a real puzzler. And this took quite a number of weeks to come to the answer. But at this time, I began to read some of Dr. Martin's literature. I committed the unpardonable sin. And here Satan really got my mind. And from this point on, this book just fell apart. You know, I couldn't understand anything anymore the right way. But I looked, first of all, at scriptures which we had used as stock explanations of why one should keep the Sabbath. Isaiah 56 is a very interesting case in point. It says, "Keep you judgment and do justice, for my salvation is near to come, and my righteousness to be revealed." Now, I could see that this is end time, very clearly. And then I came down to the passage which says about eunuchs and Gentiles keeping the Sabbath. Now, I had used that scripture as a proof text that Gentiles in the end time should keep the Sabbath. But now I was beginning to ask questions as a result of Galatians. And I notice here in verse 7 that it also talks about their burnt offerings and their sacrifices being accepted in my house. And I saw the whole gamut of the Old Covenant being talked about here. Not only the Sabbath, but sacrifices. I began going through all the other scriptures in it on this subject. Isaiah 58 was another interesting one. Once again, you could say, well, this is talking about a time when they're going to rebuild the old waste places. But it says in verse 8, "Then shall your light break forth as the morning." Now, I always thought that meant Christians. I'm sure in type, you know, our light is going to break forth as the morning. I know there are other scriptures on there. But in this context here, it became very plain to me that the you being talked about in here is Israel. It says, verse 12, "They shall be of you that shall build the old waste places. You shall raise up the foundations of many generations." Then if you, in the same context, speaking to Israel, if you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, call the Sabbath a delight. Then it says, you shall delight yourself in the Lord, and I will cause you to ride upon the high places of the earth. Now this is you, Israel. And then it struck me, it says, I will feed you with the heritage of Jacob, your father. Now I thought, are we being fed with the heritage of Jacob, our father, in the sense that this means it, as Christians, if we keep the Sabbath? Well, no, it's not happening. It was like Malachi 3:10. Where tithing is talked about. And it says, I'll pour you out a blessing, there shall not be room enough to receive it. And I started to realize, well now, we're not being poured out a blessing that there shall not be room enough to receive it. In fact, a member of the London church sent in a letter along about that time, in which he pointed that out. And he said, that's talking about nationally, and it's talking about you as a nation, and the storehouse being the temple, and all of this type of thing. And I began to see all of these scriptures were national. I began to realize the whole Old Covenant was national, that it was a package of a communal nature, and that it was not speaking to individuals, and particularly not to Christians. I went over to Isaiah 66, another proof text. We had a lot of campaigns in Britain last year, and the final lecture was the Sabbath, and that's when the attendance dropped off. And these were some of the proof texts we used. This Isaiah 66 was one of them. I can remember Richard Plochet getting up and loudly proclaiming this one. But I started to realize that when it talks about in verse 23, all flesh from one Sabbath to another, and I said, well, there you are, there's the Sabbath in force, and we taught people that. I also started to realize that it says in verse 21, I will take of them for priests and for Levites. And I looked at the whole context. And it was rather shocking. Here were people coming up to worship before the Lord, which was interesting. They weren't staying in their own area and doing it. And then I went over to Zechariah chapter 14, and I found the same thing. In Zechariah 14, here were Egyptians coming up to Jerusalem to keep the feast. Now, the question that comes to mind is, why weren't they keeping it down in Egypt? Here they were coming up to Jerusalem. And then in verse 20, I noticed that not only were they keeping the feast, but here is the Lord's house, and there are bowls before the altar, and every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah is holiness, and it talks about all there that sacrifice. Here once again, in a proof text used to prove we should keep the Feast of Tabernacles, were sacrifices. The whole Mosaic package together. And I went through all the scriptures we used, and I could not find one, not one, in which I could find only part of the package in force. It was either all in or all out. And this struck us on healing very forcibly. That God dealt with Israel in quite a different way to what he deals with us today. Now, once these proof texts began to fall apart, there was only one really left that was a problem to me. And Dr. Martin's literature helped on this one. And that was Genesis chapter 2. In Genesis chapter 2, the Sabbath seemed to be ordained at creation. Therefore, it would be exempt from the law of Moses, which as a package is set aside. Now, this was a puzzler for a while. But I knew we ultimately, in fact, Dr. Stavronidis pointed this out to me. He said, well, you're ultimately going to have to, if you're going to blue pencil part of this, and I saw that as an organization, we have blue penciled all kinds of parts of the law, you know, the seventh year land rest, and we would say, well, you can do this, but don't do that, and we go through the books of the law and pick and choose. It says keep the feast, but it says keep it in Jerusalem. Well, we say, no, don't keep it in Jerusalem, and don't keep it in booths, but keep it in, well, wherever, you know. And I saw how we blue penciled laws all the way through. I saw how even on the Sabbath, where it says that the stranger in your gates is to keep it, that we blue pencil that part of the Ten Commandments, and we say, well, no, we can keep the Sabbath, but don't quite do it in that way. And I saw the whole thing was communal. Well, I looked at this passage, and I began to realize that it says here the Sabbath was blessed, it was sanctified, but nowhere does it say that people were at that time commanded to keep it. Then I began to realize that over in Nehemiah, isn't it chapter 9, verse 13? I think it's somewhere in there. And then over in Ezekiel, chapter 20. I got this in my notes somewhere, but I've lost them. But anyway, you're familiar with the particular scriptures. Yes, Ezekiel 20, verses 10 through 12, and Nehemiah 9, verses 13 through 14. That God revealed the Sabbath to Israel, and then in Exodus 16, 22 through 29, that he gave it to Israel for the first time when they came out of the promised land. And it pictured coming out of bondage into a rest. And he never gave it to other people, and it was not known by other people before that time. Now, there were one or two problem scriptures which I had to wrestle with. The one in Exodus 16 I might quickly turn to. Exodus 16. And verse 22, where God first revealed the Sabbath, and yet it says, how long refuse you to keep my laws? Now, this was a puzzler for a little while, but not too long, because I also found that Abraham, in Genesis 26:5, was given laws and commandments and statutes. And I realized that that did not necessarily mean the whole gamut. Because if he was given the whole gamut of commandments, meaning the Ten Commandments, then he was also given the statutes. But Abraham was allowed to do things in his day, and sacrifice and all of that, that were forbidden by later statutes. So I began to realize that laws, you know, when you're locked into a system. And whenever you go through the word, go through the Bible, and you come across laws or commandments, 10 flashes all over the place. But I began to realize that laws don't have to mean 10 any more than statutes have to mean the sacrifices and things called statutes, the same Hebrew word, and the law. That God gave people laws and things at different times and commandments and statutes, but that doesn't mean the same ones given to Moses for the children of Israel. So when it said, how long refuse you to keep my commandments and my laws, well, that became very plain suddenly. They were given laws and commandments from the time they began to come out of Egypt. And they rebelled all the way. But it doesn't say the Sabbath. But now here they had been given the Sabbath earlier, and that was the one that just capped it off, because they weren't going to keep this one either. Well, Genesis 2, the last real objection I had, finally fell into place. And I realized that when God says he sanctifies something, it can mean set apart for a holy purpose. He rested on that day, sanctified that day, as a type of what he was later going to do to Israel in giving them a day, and also as a type of other things for a Christian. And I began to realize the Christian Sabbath is quite different to the Old Testament Sabbath. I saw that Israel were given acts to perform which constituted holiness, that it was a designated holiness, not an actual intrinsic holiness. And this was a startling concept. I saw that days were sanctified for Israel, but we are sanctified all the time. I saw that Israel was to offer sacrifices, but we are a living sacrifice. That Israel had holy breeches and all of this type of thing that made them holy, and meats, and this, you know, all of the laws about holiness. But that we are holy intrinsically, and that we don't need some external things to make us holy. I think there was one other scripture which I ought to mention that was a problem for me. And that was Matthew chapter 5, verse 17. Now, I knew what this one didn't mean, but I didn't know for a long time, in fact, not until very long ago, what it did mean. Think not that I am come to destroy the law, in verse 17, or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. And then it talks about every jot and tittle, none of it passing away till all be fulfilled. Now, I thought that can't mean that the whole gamut of laws given to Moses remains unchanged for a Christian. Because Christ went right on here not only to knock over Aleph's and Beth's, but to wipe out whole commandments in the way they had applied to Israel. To change them. I realized that circumcision was set aside as a physical ritual, and many other things. So I knew what it didn't mean. It did not mean that the whole law was to continue right on as it had been. Now, Richard Plashey was the one who finally came up with the explanation of this, but it was based on something Mr. Hunting discovered. That was over in Matthew 7 and verse 12, right in the same context. Therefore, all things whatever you would that men should do to you, do you even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. This is the law and the prophets. Now, if you were to look at the Old Testament law and the prophets, it's not quite that. In fact, they were told to not allow Ammonites in and to kill Canaanites and all kinds of things that really don't quite represent love to neighbor, meaning everyone. There was a change, a very definite change. Israel was a community separate from the rest of the world. But here it's talking about all men. And this is the law and the prophets. And Mr. Hunting twigged on this one first. And we began to see that the law and the prophets for a Christian is different to the law and the prophets for the Gentiles, for the Israelites. Now, that was quite a revolutionary concept to my mind. But when Christ said, whoever shall therefore break one of these least commandments, he was not looking back in time, saying the package as it had been, break one of these least and one jot and tittle of that. But he was looking forwards to the reinterpreted law. Because at this juncture, he took the law, he reinterpreted it, and now he said, this is the law and the prophets, and whoever breaks one of these least reinterpreted commandments. I went over to Luke 16, which made this one very, very clear. Luke 16, verse 16. The law and the prophets, as they had been known, were until John. Now, I'd always said the law and prophets were until and also after John. And that this meant that's all there was. But now I saw that the law and prophets, as they were until John. And yet he went on to say, since that time the kingdom of God is preached, and every man presses into it. So there were new laws, or a reinterpreted law, laws that had to do with the kingdom of God. And it is easier for heaven and earth to pass than one tittle of the law to fail. And I began to realize that means of the law as Christ reinterpreted it for Christians and not as it was given to Moses. Because the next verse says, whoever puts away his wife and marries another commits adultery. And that is the new covenant legislation on divorce, not the old. And it's quite different to the old. Well, that was the last one. Since that time, a lot of other things have fallen into place. But basically, my mind had been freed from all of the scriptures that had been wrongly used to establish something. And I think I can explain most of them now fairly clearly. The big problem in someone's mind, if there are people, maybe if we send the tape out or if others begin to ask questions who are a part of the system that I've just come out of, the big problem that they have is to free their minds to open it, their thinking, to be willing to say, could we be wrong? You know, when you're locked into a system of believing that this is the true church, therefore it must be right, or that there can be minor errors, your mind is not free to consider these things I've gone through this morning. Mine wasn't, until the shock of DNR 14 months ago, which began to free up my thinking. And now I could look at the Bible, and instead of trying to have to prove a case, instead of trying to have to defend, well, we couldn't be wrong, I could just look at it objectively and say, well, now what does it say? Does it prove the Sabbath and the holy days, or doesn't it? And I began to realize, no, it doesn't. And that's the change that took place. Well, I'm very excited about it. It's been an exciting experience for me, and I'm glad I could come along and tell you a little bit about my thinking and how it began to open my mind. And I'm certainly very grateful for Dr. Martin, who was the one who first began to really go into these things and make them available to all of us. And my only hope is that an awful lot of my friends who are locked into a system of thinking which just doesn't free them to look at this book objectively can somehow begin to say, well, what does the book say? I hope they can do it.